I'm Doug Ullman, and I appreciate everybody coming. I think the people who have ventured all the way up here in the rain clearly are interested in the topic, which is awesome. And it's really cool to be here with so many people that I look at and I know. And it's sort of humbling because there are so many people in the audience here who are doing phenomenal things. And I would love to be sitting there listening to many of you talk about what you're doing so I can learn more and we can find ways to collaborate. So we're going to keep this really informal. And what I thought I'd do is just start off with some sort of contextual comments. I'm going to show you a quick video and then talk about two specific sort of opportunities that we as a movement are working on, which I think highlight the role that social media plays, not only in cancer, but more broadly in healthcare. And then I'm going to leave plenty of time at the end for discussion and Q&A, and I hope that it can be sort of a highly engaged session. So the title of this session, obviously, is Social Media Cures Cancer and Speaks for Survivors. Probably a little bit provocative for some, but in my opinion, totally accurate. And that's for a few reasons. One, for those of you who don't know, cancer is on the verge of becoming the number one cause of death around the world. It is a disease or a group of hundreds of diseases that actually, unfortunately, take from us 8 million people every year around the world. So for context, that 8 million number is more than AIDS, malaria, and tuberculosis combined. And yet, for some reason, historically, over the last few decades, cancer has become an old, stale problem. It's not something that people, it seems intractable. People don't know what to do. They don't know how they can participate in the solution. They don't know how they can activate or be mobilized around it, other than the main call to action, which from decade to decade to decade has been fundraising. People have said, you know what, if you want to solve this problem, you raise money and you give it to someone else and they will solve the problem for you. And that is the old way of thinking. That's the old model of thinking. This problem is not going to be solved by someone else somewhere else. It's going to be solved by people like those of us in this room who care and who've had personal experiences and who want to see massive social change. So on the one hand, from a contextual standpoint, you've got, again, this massive problem that affects each and every one of our lives. And then you couple that with social media. So maybe an odd pairing or an odd couple, but if you think about the scope and scale of cancer, there's only one other thing in our society that is as open and accessible and that touches all of our lives. And that's these social tools and these social platforms that didn't exist, many of them even at one decade or 10 years ago. So we've got this massive problem, and we have to figure out a way to mobilize people, and these platforms and these tools are exactly the way to do that. So by way of background, let me just tell you two things about our organization at Livestrong. And that is that we focus all of our attention in two areas. One is direct service to people and families that have cancer or who are impacted by cancer. And the second is advocacy. How do we mobilize communities and individuals all over the world to help solve this problem at the highest level that we can? So direct service and advocacy, two-pronged approach. And the interesting thing about those two areas of focus is that they are two totally different disciplines. And most organizations in the health space or in the nonprofit space focus on one or the other, because direct service is a very specific set of skills and expertise, and advocacy and grassroots mobilization is a very different skill set and set of expertise. So the one thing that bridges the two is how you use these social tools and social platforms. And I'm going to give an example a little bit later of both, one from the direct service side and one from the advocacy side. So before I do that, I thought it was important to at least give you the context of our work and who we are as a social movement. And to do that, we are celebrating this year our 15th year as an organization and as a social movement. And so we created a very short 4-minute video. And the point of this video is not to not to promote our organization, but it's going to give you a little bit more context when I get into some of the specific examples of how I think we can use these tools to better society and not just in the cancer world.
On Wednesday, October 2nd, I was diagnosed with testicular cancer. I'm determined to fight this disease, and I will win.
My doctor told me about something called complication of cure. I felt like it was my duty to be honest about my story and provide hope.
It was a high-risk proposition. There was no guarantee that there wouldn't be a recurrence of cancer. It all started to take momentum when we competed in and won in 1999 through France.
That's awesome. That's across the line.
With that, all of a sudden, we had momentum overnight.
Years, you have people that are surviving cancer. They're being put back into the real world because of the illness that they're affecting physically, they're affecting mentally, they're affecting socially. Ultimately, I think we can help define this one, survivorship.
Nike approached us in early 2004 with an idea to make yellow stand.
We want to take silicone of this pan, we want to make them yellow and put a bit of on there, and we want to sell them all for a dollar.
I remember us kind of rolling around and saying, okay, great. Yeah, that'll really have insurance.
People wanted to run, walk, ride, whatever they could do to support this movement.
I really wanted to be a part of something greater than myself.
We have people willing to go out and get the word out, to spread the message, be an army of volunteers.
I'm running for the Life Sunshine Foundation in remembrance of my cousin. I also run in April, and I just want to get his fight out there.
You don't have to do grand things on a grand scale. You can start out small.
We're really bringing people together that truly care and truly want to make a difference.
Our recovery plan will launch a new effort to convert a disease that has touched the life of nearly every American.
I can guarantee you that a strong message will touch all corners of our society.
Cancer is clearly a global problem, and yet it's different from country to country. It needs a global response. Lance Armstrong is the foundation of the right people to do it.
We've talked to world leaders, top NGOs and individuals who are just passionate about the cause.
They believe that we would have the right to live, and most people die because they don't have the capacity to get treatment.
17 million people are predicted to die from cancer by the year 2030. We can save lives, and we must.
Absolutely helped me get on the right track doing that like that.
It's incredibly impactful to have so many people, but there's so much more to do.
We can have a world without cancer. It's going to take time, but this is the beginning of that movement. We've realized tremendous commitments and tremendous success, and this is not the end point, it's actually just the beginning.
So the point of showing you that video is really just to say that none of that ultimately would be possible without the tools that I want to talk a little bit about today. And the reason for that is that most organizations in our field, in the social sort of sector, they grow by sort of the the old model, which is that you build affiliates and you set up chapters and you sort of grow with this infrastructure across the country or around the world. The reality is that you don't have to do that anymore because you can mobilize people online and in other ways. And we've been fortunate enough to do that. So I've said this a lot before, and I'm going to say it again. The yellow wristband was the first, the original social network. I know that sounds crazy, but when this little yellow wristband came out, and you heard Mark McKinnon, one of our board members, say what a terrible idea we all thought it was. And if you ask, if you ever get the chance and you ever get to meet Phil Knight, the founder of Nike, you ask him what he thought of that idea, and he'll say, that was the worst idea I've ever seen. We thought it was impossible. We were begging retailers to sell them. We had retailers coming to us saying, well, we'll take them on consignment, but we want to be able to send them back. And we thought, they're a dollar. We don't want them back. Like, just take them, you know? And it was brutal. But the reality was is that it created these connections. It started a dialogue before there was a Facebook, before there was a Twitter. Ironically, the Livestrong Band and Facebook launched within 4 months of each other in 2004. But what this did was it gave us almost immediately 80 million people who self-selected and said, I want to be a part of this. And yes, there was a fad aspect to it, but I'll tell you a quick story. I was at Whole Foods probably 3 years ago now, and I was checking out, and the young woman who was checking me out had a yellow wristband and a pink wristband on. And so I asked her, as I do everybody, and I say, do you mind me asking, why do you wear those wristbands? And she looked at me, she was probably 16 or 17 years old, and she looked at me so poised, and she said, the pink one is for my mom who had breast cancer, and the yellow one is for everybody else who has cancer. And I thought, that's pretty good. That's pretty powerful for a little piece of silicon that weighs less than an ounce. And so it gave us this army of people, these 80 million people. And the other thing that it did, and I've said this before and I'll say it again, I really believe that it democratized philanthropy because everybody could play for a dollar. There was no class system. There wasn't this idea that you had to have time or a lot of money to be active or to be equal in the movement. So it created this totally democratic movement. And again, this was before there were any of these online tools. And so we used to sit around and we used to say, okay, well, how are we going to mobilize these 80 million people? We know they want to tell their stories. At the time, you know, people had their own blogs, but there was no real tools for people to be able to share. And so when this phenomenon, this yellow wristband started to take off and Oprah looks in her camera and says, you know, please go buy one right now. I mean, we were shocked. First of all, we had Yahoo calling us. At that time, our store was powered by Yahoo. They were calling us saying, you just crashed our servers. And 900,000 people ordered a wristband within 24 hours, which shows you the power of Oprah, if you needed another example of that. Maybe not on her new network, but as much as her old show. But it really created this conversation. And now there's very little that we do that doesn't involve the community and social media. We believe that this yellow band and the ownership of that brand are really the people who engage with it. They own the brand. It's not ours. It's not our organization's. And so I'll give you just a few examples. I mean, one of the reasons that this movement has been successful is that it's transparent, it's authentic, and it's driven by the community. And that's the same reason why all of these social tools that we'll talk about are so successful as well. The other thing is, when I started in this world, the nonprofit world, 15 years ago, I mean, things were different. I mean, you had to spend time and money to get your message out. And now people self-select to follow you in real time, and they're asking for that engagement and that conversation. And so it's totally different. But one example that I'll give you is that we now fund 90% of our programs are funded through online either competitions or community building. So we fund these what we call community impact projects. These are grants that go out to organizations all over the country. They're screened internally by the team at the foundation. They're uploaded online based on regions around the country. And what they do is they enable us to almost guarantee that the programs are going to succeed long term. So one of the problems with funding other organizations that run direct service programs is when your funding ends, you're not positive whether that program is going to continue, whether it'll be a priority for that organization. So these community impact grants are almost always sustainable because you have thousands of people who vote from that community before the organization receives the grant. So the example I'll give you is last year we had an organization that applied from Sioux Falls, South Dakota. And the organization in Sioux Falls, South Dakota got 4,800 votes from people in South Dakota. That's 4,800 people. The grant that we gave was $10,000. When our grant runs out, they've got 4,800 people that they can go to and say, look how successful this program is. All we need is $1, $5, $10, and they'll be able to generate the support long-term for that type of program. So again, it's given us a way to really engage the community in this work. Now, let me ask for a show of hands. How many people in this room use more than two social platforms per day? Yeah, right now. and by the way, I'm getting all these tweets, so I'm seeing everybody that's tweeting right now, which is cool. So if I call you out, I don't know who you are, but who's good concepts? There, see? Okay, so everybody here uses more than two a day, right? So Brooke, who I'm going to embarrass and call on here, if you don't know Brooke actually runs for our movement all of the tools that you see on the screen and many others that we use, and these are just a few examples. But, you know, again, it used to be that you were stuffing envelopes, doing direct mail, you know, spending tons of money, tons of time. And now, of all these tools and probably 20 others that we use on a daily basis, the only thing we pay for is one Flickr Pro account. It's the only money we spend on it. And Brooke's time and energy and passion and everything else, which is worth way more than $24.95, I can assure you. But it's created this community. And again, it's transformed our work. So not just in the examples that I'm going to talk about now in terms of advocacy and direct service, but everything we do is based on the community. Like today, as an example, I posted a question. I said, what kind of app should we develop for Livestrong? And we've got tons and tons of answers coming in from people who are survivors, are caregivers, or family members who are giving us this great information so that we can actually create things that people need and want to use as opposed to what we think is appropriate or what we think might be the best thing to do. So I'm going to give you an example of an advocacy effort as well as a direct service effort. So how many people here have heard of Prop 29? Nice. Wow, that's more than usual. So Prop 29 is a sort of coalition of organizations that are working on something in California. It's an organization called the Campaign for Tobacco-Free Kids. It's the American Cancer Society, American Heart Association, American Lung Association, Stand Up to Cancer, and many others who came together to try and create a model of funding for cancer research, prevention, and smoking cessation in the state of California. And what they came up with was what's called the California Cancer Research Act, which has just recently been named Prop 29. And Prop 29 is on the ballot as a ballot initiative in California on June 5th. The reason most people haven't heard of Prop 29 is that it actually just got its name a few weeks ago, and there was a lot of discussion about when this would actually be on the ballot. Would it be on the ballot last year? Would it be on the ballot this November? But it's actually now officially on the ballot on June 5th, which is both both good and bad, which I'll explain. So what does this actually do? So Prop 29 is pretty simple and it's pretty linear. It is a $1 per pack of cigarettes increase in tobacco tax. $1. Now, let me give you some statistics. California currently has the 33rd highest tobacco tax. Okay? Most people think of California as this really progressive place. When it comes to tobacco taxation, they are 33rd, which means their tax per pack of cigarettes is 87 cents. If they pass a $1 increase, which they will on June 5th, they will get up to 16th. So they'll still be sort of in the middle tier. There are only 5 states in the United States who have not increased their tobacco tax in the last 10 years. California is one of them. Kentucky has increased their tobacco tax more recently. North Carolina has increased their tobacco tax more recently. California has not. So why is that? Well, this type of effort has been on the ballot several times. And every time it's been on, the last time was in 2006, the tobacco industry spends tens of millions of dollars to defeat it. Last time they spent about $70 million. This year, they're going to spend $100 million. They're going to spend $100 million basically between April 15th and June 5th. And as an example of the way they operate, which is not a shock, I don't think, to anybody here, our organization put in $1.5 million to this campaign about 3 weeks ago. And $1.5 million for us is the legal limit that we can put in because it's direct lobbying. And we have strict guidelines on what we can and can't do. So 1.5 was the maximum amount that we could put in. The day after, that was on a Thursday morning, the day after, RJR put in $7 million just to sort of put out their own little release. And show that they were going to have way more money. Now, how can we possibly win? This failed by 4.5% in 2006. Campaign of nonprofits spent about $4 million, and the tobacco industry spent $70 million. And the polling is exactly the same today as it was this many days ahead of the election in 2006. So the polling today, our polling, shows 63% in favor, which is exactly where it was before, and they were able to spend $70 million and swing that the other direction. So the key is getting people to vote. And we were having this conversation recently with some of our partners in California, and we said, look, what's the way to really have an impact? And I should also say that, so what does it do? What does $1 per pack of cigarettes do? This is sort of the scary fact. 855 million packs of cigarettes sold per year in California. So it would raise $855 million in the first year. And that money is mandated to be spent on cancer research, prevention, and smoking cessation in the state of California. So the win-win on this is that that amount goes down 3% every year. So the only thing scientifically proven to reduce the amount of people who smoke is increase in taxation. So think about that. All of the ads you see for products, for whatever therapeutics that are supposed to help people quit smoking, very few of them, if any of them, work. And if someone tries to quit smoking, and maybe somebody in this room has done this before, I've never been addicted, but I understand how hard of an addiction it is to kick. But if you try to stop smoking and you're unsuccessful, the average is you won't try again for 18 months. So you might buy this thing on TV for $19.99, you try it, it doesn't work, you wait another 18 months, then you try something else, it doesn't work. The only thing proven to work is taxation, and it really only works for people under the age of 30. So older adults will figure out a way to pay for it. 3,800 kids under the age of 18 in the US every day become addicted to cigarettes. So it is still a massive problem, although many in this room and many others may not see that every day or experience it every day. So 855 million, and then that goes down 3% each and every year based on the number of people who stop smoking. So we're trying to figure out how do we really mobilize and how do we win? And it's all going to be about social media. So the coalition of groups is going to have about $10 million to spend, and the tobacco industry is going to spend $100 million. And the interesting thing is that while we've all seen Twitter and Facebook used around the world, like in the Arab Spring and other examples, what you don't often see is an example of something that's very tangible in terms of a date certain, a vote that you can track back to an experience a few years ago where the exact same vote was unsuccessful. So in talking to Dick Costolo at Twitter as an example, and he sort of said, wait a minute. He said, all we got to do is we got to use these tools to make up 4.5%. And then we can prove that these tools played a massive role, being outspent 10-1, but we can use this as a case study. And so we're talking to Twitter and Facebook and others about how we can use their tools free of charge to mobilize and really target tons of people. So the hard part about this election is not only the funding gap in terms of 10-1 against, but it's also that the June 5th ballot, there's not a whole lot on the ballot. So nobody's running against President Obama, so there's no presidential sort of primary on the Democratic side. And so there are only certain districts in California where there are going to be really significant congressional primaries, as an example, where there'll be high turnout. And so we have to use these tools to really, really focus on certain populations. The other thing we have to do, and those of you from California know this, that half the people who vote in June are going to vote by mail. And those people vote within 48 hours of getting their ballot, and they'll get their ballot anywhere from May 2nd to May 3rd. So we have to target them online in certain areas on May 2nd and May 3rd and then we have to stop spending, and then we have to wait till June 3rd, 4th, 5th, right before Election Day, and use our resources in a really efficient sort of way. So if we can mobilize people and get them out, we will win, and I think it'll be a great case study of sort of how you use social media to ultimately have a huge impact on the cancer burden. Because $855 million a year going into prevention research, smoking cessation, will have an enormous impact on people, not just in California, but all over the world. Because whatever gets developed, we need to make sure people all over the world have access to it. So that's an example from the advocacy side that's top of mind for us as a movement. And obviously there'll be a lot more that you'll hear about it. But June 5th will be hopefully a great day of celebration for our cause and for everybody that's been involved. So let me talk just for a minute about the other side of the work that we do with social media, and that is sort of the direct service. How do you inspire and empower people and provide them with tools when they are unfortunately diagnosed with this life-threatening and very overwhelming experience? I always tell people that when I was diagnosed 15 years ago, the internet was in its infancy, and you actually used books. I mean, imagine being diagnosed with cancer and going to Barnes & Noble, if there was a Barnes & Noble, but buying a book about cancer, or buying a book about, it's a different world, and obviously now information is at our fingertips. But what was always missing in my experience was that connection to somebody else who was dealing with the exact same thing. How do you build a community around you that is people who truly understand? And one of the things that's become interesting to us as an organization, and again, Brooke knows this better than anyone, is that most of our referrals of families that are impacted by cancer who are in need of resources and tools and support come through Facebook. Now, that may not be sort of shocking, right? But think about it. It in our world, it used to be that your doctor, your nurse, your social worker, somebody would hand you a pamphlet or brochure, there'd be a number, call, and you never really knew whether that person was going to call. You never really knew sort of if that would sort of get through. You never knew if the nurse or the doctor or the social worker would actually give out the information. Maybe it was just on a wall in the waiting room. Maybe it was on a table or a coffee table. But now what's happening is somebody's diagnosed with cancer. They're sharing their own personal story on their Facebook page. Somebody saying, hey, you should call this organization or that organization, and it becomes this sort of instant way to connect with people. The most frustrating thing for us is when we hear from people who say, I wish I would have known that those resources existed when I needed them, because that's our fault. I mean, how are we not doing a better job of reaching them in real time? And more recently, we were able to go work with Facebook last summer on some new tools that allow us to interact with people in a more private, personal way. So those of you who are familiar with Facebook will know that on a fan page, which is what we have, there was no way for us to interact one-on-one. So if somebody posted a message about their own cancer experience, Brooke, as an example, couldn't dialogue with them in a non-public forum. And so Facebook asked us to come out and talk about the functionality that we would need to use to have better to offer better services to our constituents, and that was one of them. And luckily now we're able to do that, which again gives you the public setting of Facebook to bring the filter or the funnel of people, but then also allows you to interact in a more private, personal way. But the beauty of these tools is that people can share their stories, and our experience in dealing with many, many cancer survivors, thousands and thousands of cancer survivors, is that people want to share their story. They want to have a platform to express the good, the bad, and the ugly. And the pictures of those on the screen are just a small sampling, a few examples of people who these tools have allowed to share their story. And one of the things that we do now every week is that we share a very personal story from somebody in the Livestrong community each and every week on our blog, and sometimes it involves video. But the idea is that you're empowering people and you're offering them the tools in real time when they need them. So another example of that is somebody that many of you may be familiar with from ESPN, Stuart Scott, who, if you aren't familiar with, has been a sports anchor for ESPN for many years, an amazing, amazing guy, diagnosed with advanced colon cancer probably 6 or 7 years ago now. This guy is—he's so passionate and he's so fit, and he does P90X and he does Ultimate Fighting, and he's just sort of constantly working out. And diagnosed with colon cancer, went through a series of treatments, and then about a year and a half ago had a recurrence pretty widespread metastases. Amazing guy. You'll see him on TV tonight, tomorrow, whatever. But he goes in for treatment every Monday. He's home for 48 hours. He goes back to work on Wednesday afternoon. He anchors SportsCenter on Wednesday night. I mean, just the best attitude in the world. And he will tell you that, and he tweets about it all the time. I mean, social media is his support group. I mean, he gets so much inspiration from this community. And people always say, oh, Stuart inspires me. And he tweets everybody back. He responds to everybody constantly. And it's funny, he doesn't email. We had to email him something the other day, and he like doesn't check his email, but he's on Twitter like nonstop. And I'm like, how do we attach this document to get it to him on Twitter? But couldn't figure that out. But he is one of these people that says, like, look, everybody's looking at me as if I'm giving so much to the community. He says, I'm giving a fraction of what I'm getting just by opening up and sharing his own personal story. So both in terms of sort of the advocacy side, which we talked about, and then the direct service side in terms of how do you reach people in real time and give them access. You heard a little bit in the video, and this is one of the other reasons why I believe that social media will be sort of the answer to our problem, and that is that a lot of the issue in cancer is not new breakthroughs. And I know there are people in the room that focus on research and science, and this is not a derogatory comment against anything in that realm. But the reality is that of the 8 million people who die every year, 4 million of them die because they don't get access to something we already have today that we know works. And that is, as I think a lot of us would agree, that is the biggest moral and ethical failure of our time. How can we sit by and let people suffer and die based on who they are and maybe how much money they have or where they live or the color of their skin or any number of factors? I mean, that's unacceptable. And one of the things that social media does is it allows us to reach people who otherwise might not have access. And so we have to figure out a way to leverage these tools and platforms to actually translate into better care and better access for people all over the world. I mean, it is not fair that someone in Austin, Texas today is diagnosed with cervical cancer and has a 100% chance of remission, where someone in South Africa is diagnosed at the exact same minute, at the exact same time, and may die in a month because they don't get the same level of treatment or care. And unfortunately, that happens every single day. And it doesn't just happen in other parts of the world. It happens, obviously, as we all know, right here in our country. So, the beauty for our organization, our movement, is that these tools, they level the playing field. And cancer, in my opinion, when you hear the words, you have cancer, it puts everybody on the same playing field. Doesn't matter how smart you are, doesn't matter how much money you have, doesn't matter where you live. I mean, you are reduced to deal with the exact same issues that the person next to you and the person next to you have to deal with. And social media is the same way. It levels the playing field. It's free, it's easy, and everyone has access to it. And so we have to figure out better ways to utilize those tools to translate that into results. And I think we can do that, but it's going to take a lot of people engaging in a lot of solutions around this. So Prop 29 is one example, and only one example, that we think, if successful, will lead to other opportunities in other parts of the country and also around the world. So the last thing I would leave you with before I open it up to questions is that cancer has also always been seen as a disease of the developed world. People think that cancer is a disease that the United States, North America, Western Europe really deal with the majority of, and that is not correct. 70% of all new diagnoses are in the developing world, and only 5% of all resources that are devoted to cancer are devoted to the developing world. So this is no longer a disease that only we are concerned about, or only people in Western Europe are concerned about. This is a disease of the entire world. And the reality is that the global sort of health agenda has been driven by communicable disease, which has been vital and important and crucial, and the success has been off the charts. The unintended consequence of that success is that as people survive communicable disease and people live longer, they will be burdened with cancer and other non-communicable diseases, whether it be diabetes, cardiovascular disease, etc. So we have to figure out a way to invest in the health infrastructure to deal with all of these issues, not just one different or one type of disease or illness. So this is a huge problem. It's daunting. But again, these tools allow us to accomplish things that would never have been possible. And they level the playing field, and they give a voice to each and every person who wants to engage in it. And again, I think that's the parallel between this yellow wristband and these tools, they're both available to everybody, and they help democratize the playing field and the process. So I am incredibly optimistic, even though this is a daunting task. And the reality is that there are millions of people around the world that are counting on us collectively to solve these problems. And again, people should not suffer and die based on where they live, who they are, or what resources they have available to them currently. And so we have to commit ourselves to do a better job to make sure that we can alleviate that suffering and that burden that the disease causes. So we are entirely committed to doing that. As I say often internally to our team, you know, we like to say that we're both naive and audacious, and we're naive enough to think that we can change the world, and we're audacious enough to try. And if we fail, we will only have saved a few million lives and helped improve the quality of life for millions of others. And, you know, it's pretty rare that we, again, collectively, that we would all have the chance to impact people's lives in such a dramatic way. And so I thank you for trekking up here in the rain. I thank you for the work that you do, because I know so many people in this room personally, and I know the incredible work that you're doing on a daily basis. And I hope that that all of you will consider us just partners and conduits and catalysts in the work that you're doing. And if there's anything we can do to help, we would love to do that. And I will stop there and open it up to any questions that people might have. Thank you. And I've been told that we have to use the microphone because it's being recorded. Questions, comments? Jay.
Jay Dreyer, CareFlash. Can you talk a little bit, Doug, if you would, please, about your navigation offering and your experience since you launched it in what was not long ago?
So, thanks, Jay. We've been focusing on what we call a cancer navigation. And navigation, as most of you know, has become sort of a buzzword in the health field. And the idea is, like, how do you get people what they need, when they need it, you know, and make sure that things run smoothly. And fortunately for us, we have a board member named Harold Freeman, who is an oncologist, practicing surgeon in Harlem, been in Harlem for almost 50 years. If you don't know, and if you're in New York and you ever want to be inspired, go to Harlem and go to what's called the Ralph Lauren Cancer Center and visit with Dr. Freeman and have him take you on a tour. About 6 years ago, and if Lance were here, he would tell you the story, but about 6 years ago, Lance and Dr. Freeman were on the president's cancer panel together, and Dr. Freeman kept saying, "You got to come to Harlem, Lance. You got to come to Harlem. You got to come to Harlem." And Lance is like, "I'm a kid from Plano, Texas. I've never been to Harlem." Like, you know, and so we were in New York, and Lance is like, "Maybe we should go to Harlem." And so we go up there, and Dr. Freeman's taking Lance on this tour of his center, and he's pointing out things. He's saying, this is that, the whole thing. And then he stops Lance, and he stops in the hallway, and he says, "Lance, this is what you don't understand." And Lance is like, "Well, what do you mean?" He says, "What you don't understand is what you see here is the difference between what we know and what we do." He said, "We know how to save these people's lives. We know how to help them navigate the system. We just don't do it." And he says that delta, the difference between what we know and what we do, is a moral failure. And it was a real transformational day, I know, for Lance. And so we tried to figure out how could we take that concept of navigation and apply it to what we were doing here at the foundation. And so we opened a navigation center in East Austin. For those of you not from Austin, like many American cities, Austin is has been historically very divided east and west of the highway, I-35. And so our headquarters and our navigation center are in East Austin, which is predominantly or has been predominantly Hispanic Latino side of town. And the idea was, could you create a center that linked all of the resources in a city and helped people get, again, where they need to go, when they need to be there, and improve care? And so we opened last March, and so far the traffic in terms of the number of clients coming into the center is way higher than we expected. Three times what we expected, Brooke says. We've hired more and more navigators who are primarily social workers, and their job is simply, they're empowered to basically do anything they need to do to remove barriers that people come in with. So a couple examples. One of the first people that came into the navigation center was a gentleman in his 60s who was getting radiation therapy 4 days a week in downtown Austin, and he lived on the east side and didn't have a car. And so he was walking to treatment, mile and a half every day, walking to radiation, walking back, walking to radiation, walking back. I mean, he didn't realize that there was a city program that would pick him up and take him. So it was one phone call from a navigator to Cap Metro to say, hey, this guy needs a ride. So did he need a new treatment? Wasn't that he needed, you know, it was just connecting the dots of services that already existed. Woman walked in not too long ago. She was Venezuelan, Spanish speaking. I think she was 41 years old. I can't remember what type of cancer she had. I apologize. But she came in with $7,100 in bills. Just a stack of paper. She had no idea. So our financial navigator sat down with her and literally within 15 minutes realized that she was eligible for a federal program that would take $5,400 off immediately. I mean, no idea. People just don't know. And how could they? How would they? You know, how would any of us? So it's helping people navigate any number of issues, whether they're physical, whether they're clinical, whether they're financial. And the goal is not only improving people's quality of life and improving their outcomes or their chances of surviving, but also, can this save money? Because the amount of money we're spending on the navigation center versus the amount of money spent when someone shows up at the emergency room or someone shows up at the wrong place at the wrong time is really stark. So we just are launching a new pilot because all of the research we did locally showed that one of the biggest issues in this city was transportation. People literally couldn't get to treatment. They couldn't get to screening. They couldn't get wherever they needed to go. So we're launching a pilot program that will help on the transportation side. So the idea is, how can we now scale this? And, you know, can we scale this through iPads? Can we have the intake and all of the resources that you would receive if you walked into the center in East Austin available to somebody in any community around the country? My dream has always been that we would create a sort of copy the Teach for America model, and that we would go out and we would get tons of people, young and old, to sign up to spend a year or two of their life serving in their community. And you would give them an iPad and you give them all the resources and you say, you know what, we're going to do this like a political campaign. You're going to go door to door. You're going to be in communities, on the streets, because that's Dr. Freeman's big thing. Dr. Freeman's big thing, if those of you know him or have seen him talk, is he just says, look, the war on cancer that Nixon declared in 1971 has been fought in the research labs. He said this war needs to be fought on the street, in communities, getting people screened, getting people access, making sure they get to their treatment, making sure they have childcare, whatever the issues are, you know, alleviated. And it's sort of the model of, some of you may be familiar with this model of Ritz-Carlton, but Ritz-Carlton's known for their training of their employees. And if you read their books, they talk about how they empower their staff. And the staff at the Ritz-Carlton, doesn't matter whether you're working at the front desk or you're working in valet or wherever you're working, the staff of the Ritz-Carlton is empowered to spend $2,000 per guest at any point in time without asking any manager. Somebody pulls up, they spilled on their tuxedo, they need a new tuxedo, $2,000. Whatever they need, you don't have to ask. And the reality is they never have to spend the money because the team is empowered to remove the barriers and burdens and help the people. And so I know it sounds like a sort of a weird analogy, but it's sort of like we just tell our navigators, do whatever it takes. The problem with navigation has become that people don't like to be denavigated. is a big problem because the navigators develop these close relationships, and there's sort of these parameters where a navigator could be working with maybe, say, 60 to 100 people at any given point in time. Well, a lot of the clients, they love it, and they keep coming back. And so at some point, you know, you have to sort of say to somebody, okay, we got you through, and now you're on your own. You know, we've helped throughout the continuum, but now you're denavigated, and that's not an easy conversation. Jack. So Jack and I had never met, I don't think. Have we ever met in person?
No, not yet.
But we've corresponded a lot, and Jack's from Seattle, and he's doing amazing things.
Well, thank you. But I wanted to ask, you know, I'm an oncologist, and I mean, I agree with a huge amount of what you said. And I think one of the limitations, though, is that as remarkable as Livestrong has been in galvanizing the lay public, and it has been remarkable, the physicians and the entire health, you know, professional community are relative laggards in technology and social media. And,
that's an understatement.
Yeah. So you do what you can. But so to what extent has that been a limitation, and how can we overcome that? How can Livestrong or others of us overcome these limitations and bring professionals, physicians, and other healthcare professionals to engage, interact directly in this? Because I think that really is a limitation.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I think it's a huge problem. I mean, I think healthcare in general, as you said, we're so far behind the rest of the world in terms of, or other sectors in terms of utilization of technology. I'll tell you that years ago when Google launched Google Health, which is now, you know, no more, I was invited to be on this advisory panel for Google Health, and there were probably 20 people there, and it was really interesting. Six or seven of the people were only talking about HIPAA. They were sort of legal scholars, and that was their whole thing. Like, we can't do this because of HIPAA. We can't do this because, like, and it just dominated the conversation. And then they got to a point where they wanted to have this feature where you would interact with your physicians, ask questions, get information, all this stuff. And part of that was ratings, you know, letting the patient rate the physician. And there was two whole days of debate. And one of the people on the committee was from the AMA. And they were like, no way, can't do it. It's not fair. It's not, you know, like everything in our world is rated nowadays. And there was this big debate. And so there's always, I think, been this tension between sort of how much, I mean, I'm not picking on you, but how much do physicians want to really sort of open up and be totally transparent? I think what we see a lot of is the way or lack thereof of data sharing. So we do a survey every 2 years called the Livestrong Survey, and we send it out to, I think last time it went to like 10 or 11,000 survivors. And it's like a 45 minute to an hour survey. And we get all this data back, and that's what drives the development of our programs. What are the needs of the people that we serve? And the most startling thing that we got back last time was all around data and privacy. And there were some interesting things. I mean, one interesting thing was that in our world, the people that we talk to, people with cancer, their concern about privacy was minimal. I mean, and I know it sounds sort of crazy, but people with cancer already feel like they're being discriminated against. They feel like people know that they have cancer. And as long as they're getting value out of whatever the tools are, they'll share their information in their story. They're not as scared, worried, nervous as I think a lot of people think. Now, if you're not getting value out of it, then yeah, we don't want that information floating around in other people's hands. But the other thing that we found was that one of the biggest issues was who owns the data. And I'll give you my own personal example. Like, I go twice a year now for my follow-up care to MD Anderson in Houston. When I go there, they claim that they own the data. They claim that they own my information. And if I ask, hey, I need to take that with me, it's the most arduous process in the world, costs money, takes time, they can't find stuff, that, you know. And people that responded to the Livestrong survey said, all we need is a way to share data. Because if I can share my data, then I can get second opinions, I can send it to you and say, what do you think? And it sort of opens up these opportunities. The other thing it does is it opens up the opportunity
to increase enrollment in clinical trials. Because if we had a platform for sharing data, then a researcher anywhere who's doing a study, a long-term study on, you know, melanoma survivors or sarcoma survivors, in my case, I could self-select and say, oh, I want to sign up for that. But right now, there's no way for, you know, physician scientists to interact with survivors in a sort of structure that works. And the problem is that all of the health system, all of the technology systems in healthcare are sold and marketed to the institutions. And there's no sort of exchange. So what we're trying to build, and it's really hard because you've got all these companies with billions of dollars playing in the space, what we're trying to build is this health exchange. So a platform where somebody with cancer can say, you know what, I am uploading my information into this exchange so that it's available and people can contact me, even if it's anonymously, to say, are you interested in this? Or what about this? Or I'm a survivor of melanoma as well, or, you know, whatever it is. And so I think it's just hard because you've got Microsoft playing, you've got GE playing, you've got Cerner, you've got all these players and they've got all this money, but no one's thinking about the patient. Like, no one's creating the systems or designing them necessarily for the patient. So I don't know, it's a big challenge. I don't have the answer, but we want to work with you on it. We can pass it back to, I think it moves too.
Hi, Joe Doyle with HCB Health here in Austin. Kind of piggybacking on what you're going on, do you feel like part of the educating clinicians, doctors, big practices about social and how they can spread and how they can teach those affected with cancer to get out there and use those tools to best of their advantage? Is LiveStrong doing any of that? Is there any sort of education platform that you guys are considering for physicians and for large organizations? We work with Texas Oncology,
sure.
U.S. Oncology, and those places, I mean, forget about it. They're very conservative. They're not even going to get into it. So how do you handle that?
And what's interesting about that is that, you know, U.S. Oncology was bought by McKesson.
Right.
So, I mean, this is a for-profit business. So you would think that they would want to use technology to become more efficient and effective. And I don't know that we're doing anything to get, well, Brooke's saying we are, but she'll know more than me. But we're doing physician education and continuing medical education, that a lot of which is done online. But I don't know if it's focused on getting them active socially. You know, like it's not. I don't think that's the intent of the continuing education pieces. It's more around topics that we care about, so young adults with cancer, survivorship, etc. And it's done online. But I don't think it's. The goal is not, at least currently, to get practices sort of using those tools. But that's a good idea. I mean, it's really hard. I mean, one of the things, a lot of people in this room work for various nonprofits and organizations, and one of the things that's hard is, like, you know, we as an organization always talk about how, like, our goal is not to become the biggest organization, and yet there's still this old mentality of competition. And so, like, when we go into a physician's practice and say, hey, we've got these tools that we want to make available for free, you know, it's unbelievable how hard it is to get those tools in there. Because most places say, oh, no, we have those tools. Or, oh, well, that has your logo on it. It's like, we don't care. Like, put your own sticker on it. Like, as long as people are getting what they need, like, who cares who developed it? It's not about raising more money. It's not about competing for dollars. But I just think that, yeah, I think. I mean, I don't know if ASCO's doing anything around getting the membership active on social media, other than sort of interacting with each other. But
I think it's coming around. ASCO's pretty forward thinking.
Yeah,
a big kind of, you know, the way I think about it, that the medicine has been like old meat. I mean, it's just been the way it's been for centuries,
right.
And this is shaking things up. I think the only way to change it is to say the conversations will happen on social media. Do you want to be part of it? Do you want to be talked about behind your back?
Right. Yeah. I mean, I agree. Well, that was the whole discussion at Google Health around these rankings, right? So they came to this compromise after 2 days, and the compromise was, instead of ranking physicians, you would have, I think it was 3 questions. And the 3 questions were, I don't remember all of them, but I remember one of them was, would you recommend this person to someone else? That was it, yes or no. Like, there was no number scale, there was no, you know, anything. And then they brought in this expert who came from
can't remember the company at the time. This is years ago, but he was sort of an expert in online rating systems. And he basically showed all this data, which we now know is true, which is that the amount of commentary online in these rating systems that's negative is like less than 20%. But the physicians thought, oh, it'll all be negative. But the reality is people that have great experiences are the ones that are on there, you know, promoting it. So, and then the AMA said, well, we'll only do it if the physicians have a way to go in and defend themselves. Like when there's a comment posted or whatever. It's like, you don't understand. It's a conversation. Like everyone has access to it. It's not like one way or the other. But anyway, Google Health is no longer. So it hasn't happened. Sorry. We can pass it back too if you want. I think it moves. One more.
Five minutes.
Okay. Perfect. Thank you.
My name's Sabrina. I'm from DC. I want to touch on the second part of the title of this panel, Speaks for Survivors. Mm-hmm. I work with a lot of diaspora groups, bringing them into the fold and philanthropy. And I've noticed that with healthcare screenings and administrations, there are tons of tools available to bridge the language gaps, to bring them into, to get their screenings, to get their funding. But I've noticed that there's not that conversation for survivorships for patients who don't speak English.
Yep.
And I'm speaking outside of the, you know, Spanish language, you know, Arabic speaking, what have you.
Sure.
So I was wondering what tools, if there are tools available that you guys are advocating use of, because the stories are being told, but it's being told in very siloed communities.
Yeah.
And I think it would be a beautiful thing if that could be branched into the larger conversation that's happening on the social web.
Totally. I think that's a great point. I don't think we've done it. We've done a lot of work on that front, not as in-depth as you're talking about. So one of our big focuses is on Spanish-speaking populations. So we've done a lot of work on that, and 60-plus percent of the people that utilize our navigation center are Spanish-speaking, which has been awesome. And we've had to totally sort of immerse ourselves in how to use social for that population. On the beyond that, we've done, as an example, we've done a lot of work with Native American, American Indian populations. We've done a lot of work with sort of Pacific Islander populations, but it's been sort of not social necessarily. It's been more print and materials that are culturally relevant. So I think you're right. I mean, I think there's a huge opportunity. What I would also say is that one of the things we're doing around the world is working on sort of these anti-stigma campaigns. So we did research around the world about 5 years ago now, and what we found was that in many countries, there were tons of resources, and that wasn't the issue. The issue was that the resources weren't being utilized. So in South Africa, as an example, the stigma was so great around the disease that even if there was a mammography screening center, no one was going because they thought it was a death sentence. They didn't think if they were diagnosed, there was anything they could do and all that stuff. And that's happening, by the way, in plenty of communities here as well. So we launched a campaign that's both sort of old-style media as well as SMS and social media. And in some of the townships where we're working in South Africa, there was a 90% increase in the number of people that went to get screened, beyond people even sharing their story and saying, wow, I had no idea that my neighbor was a cancer survivor, because the neighbor was trained through what we call patient empowerment forums to go out and share their story in the community. And so I think so much of that can be translated to social, but I don't think we've done, you know, a great job of that. I will also tell you this research. I mean, the research showed that, like, in Mexico, two-thirds of people in Mexico, when we did this research 5 years ago, said that they thought that if they had a cancer diagnosis, it was their own fault. And three-quarters thought that it was a death sentence. And I think it was 52% of the people in Mexico thought that, this is shocking, was shocking to me, but 52% of people said that they believed that cancer in some way was contagious. And so if that's sort of the prevailing thought, then all of these great nonprofits that are doing great work on the ground in Mexico and all of these health organizations, their message wasn't getting through because the stigma. And so we went in there, we had a round table where we invited all of the organizations working on cancer in Mexico. We had them all in Mexico City for 2 days, and we basically said, look, we aren't coming here to raise money. We're not coming here to duplicate what you're doing. All we're doing is we want to use the Livestrong brand to demystify this disease, reduce the stigma, so that it will drive more people to the services that you're offering. And so far, it's been successful. I mean, we're learning a lot, but it's hard because you have to have some medical infrastructure. Otherwise, you're destigmatizing something, and then there's nowhere for people to turn, which is hard. But I think there's a lot of potential in what you're talking about. Okay, it's 4:30. Thank you again for coming out. Look, the sun's coming out. It's going to be awesome now. It's going to be like 60. So thank you very much.